here in. Thank you all for coming. I know that all of you know that we live in interesting times, hopefully not the Chinese curse version of them. But there are some things, there are some announcements and updates that we'll be making today on the usual, on all of our usual subjects, but they're really, really important things. So I really appreciate that everyone's here. First off, I would like to say that there are, since the beginning of April, things have been kind of wild and crazy around here. And there have been a number of people who have been working very hard already on a lot of the consultations that we've been having, particularly with education and with life sciences. And I just want to thank all the people who have really worked very hard in making sure that all of that has gone as well as we might expect. Particularly have a debt of gratitude to Dr. Cruz, I guess Dean Emeritus Dr. Cruz, and to Daniel Boyer, who had special formal roles in dealing with a lot of the life sciences consultations. So there are a number of things. One of the most important milestone days for us was, of course, June the 3rd, which was the deadline for people telling us that they wanted to take the volunteer retirement program. We have 26 individuals who have taken us, who have told us that they would like to retire, and I can't even imagine how many years that is, but a lot. I mean, if you think that there are many people in that group who have worked with us for over 40 years, we're talking many years of dedicated service to McGill and to the library. And I want, for those of you who are in that program, and we're not naming people by names.
Some,
but not everybody wanted to be recognized. It's their prerogative. It's a private matter for a lot of individuals. So, but there are 26 total. And if you add to that the number who were in the program in the library's volunteer retirement program that we ran about a year and a half ago, there were 11 in that, so that brings up a total of 37 support and administrative staff. Six of those positions, of course, we filled sometime in the past when we still could fill positions. So you can see that we're undergoing a significant turnover in our staff as a whole. It will be very, very interesting times. Our next steps will be to sit down and to really concentrate once again, as we did on the retreat, concentrate on what we consider essential services, and to make sure that those are covered in appropriate ways by people classified at the appropriate levels. And we will be working on that very quickly. We also know that we have a couple of big moves that we will be going through this summer. Significant collection moves of both the LC collections in not the Osler collection, circulating collection, but the LC collection in health sciences, life sciences, and the LC collection in education will both be moving to Schulich and Hustle respectively. So there will be a huge amount of work involved in that. All librarians will be very, very much involved in some significant collection development efforts with that, and it will be a great deal of work. We will also be looking at really if we could start a library right now, what would it look like? And in a lot of ways, I think that is the sort of viewpoint that would be best for us to take. There are some places that are starting libraries from the ground just like that. For instance, the library at in Saudi Arabia, there's an education city that was built in the desert, literally just has come to being in the past 10 years, called KAUST, which has brought together some of the best minds in math and statistics and some other technology-related areas. But that library and that university was started out from the very beginning. It's virtual. It is only a research university. Its primary mission is research, so I'm not even sure that there's an undergraduate program there. The library is totally digital and is in a series of steps, actually, with wonderful architecture and water flowing through the desert. It's a very, very interesting design for a library, but they had the ability to sit down and decide what is important, what is a library for the 21st century. And I think that sort of stepping back and thinking of things like that is very important. Something as simple as reserves. Why do we do reserves? What is reserves all about? We do reserves because traditionally there was a very scarce commodity, a print book, an artifact, a physical artifact that was dear. It normally cost a significant amount of money, and it had to get to a lot of people in a relatively short amount of time. All of those factors don't exist anymore. You know, most books don't cost that much. A lot of things that we had to do in print form and physical artifact form, we no longer have to do in that way. If we think differently, if we don't just keep doing things the way we've always done them before. And we're going to be forced to do that because we simply do not have the same number of people and the same types of employment statuses that we've had in the numbers that we've had in the past. So it is not business as usual. If I've said it once, I've already said it 100 times. The only thing I can guarantee you is change. And this isn't the end of it. There is no way that this is the end of change as we've known it. I feel like I got on a treadmill. It's just gotten faster and faster and faster since I got here. This was not how I planned to spend my time when I got here. Not at all. I've never been involved in reimagining a library and libraries on the scale that we have here, ever. So it's a somewhat new experience for me as well. But as I've said in a lot of the consultations I've gone around to, we are not alone. Virtually all 100% of the libraries in our stratum within the Association of Research Libraries are downsizing their support staff. Many of them, 85% or so, are closing and merging libraries just as we are. So we are totally in the mainstream of what's happening in research libraries as a whole across this continent, really across the Western world. As you know, if you remember, the retirement program is only the first phase in the university's need to reduce the total university budget by a significant amount. The university is heading into phase two, which will involve more than likely, and as we are having scenarios played out before us right now, some layoffs. These, of course, will be targeted, as we have been saying all along, for support and administrative staff. Because of honoring union agreements, it will involve those who are not job secured, in all likelihood. But it does look as though the university has not come up to the numbers that it needed to reduce its overall payroll, to reduce the university's budget by around $45 million in recurring money. So recurring money means people. It means things that cost, that are recurring obligations. Salaries and wages are among those. We do know that the university needed around 340 positions to commit to the voluntary retirement program, and it has not come up to that. So we don't, everything has not been added up. We don't yet know how many, what what the number short of that 340 is. It's also true that there are some areas, just as within the libraries, there are some libraries and some departments that have been harder hit, have been more affected by the retirement program, and we know that we'll have to do some reshuffling of people and positions as we find out more. Within the university as a whole, of course, we will do that on the basis of, when we do that, we'll do it on the basis of making sure that we have the right classification of person doing the right level of job, the expertise of people, and of course taking their own wishes into account as well, as we may need to shift people around. But we will have to be shifting people around, there's no doubt about it. That could also happen on a larger scale with the university as a whole, because there are some places that some departments and some areas within the university whose demographics were totally flipped from ours, really. We had an unusual percentage of our staff that was eligible for the retirement program, and there are parts of the university who are just the opposite. They have few, if any, people who were eligible for the retirement program, and so the effect of the retirement program isn't equal across the university, and there may need to be some shuffling within the university as a whole. That, of course, again, will be in accordance with collective bargaining agreements and the wishes of individuals, in as much as we can manage to carry on the business of the university in doing so. I can say undoubtedly that phase two is not going to affect the library nearly as significantly as phase one. It won't happen. Going on to the consultations, there were a number of consultations for faculty, for students, for staff, for anybody who wanted to. Many, many emails that individuals have gotten on both reimagining the education and life sciences program, library programs. There have been recommendation documents, synopses of the recommendations and ideas that have come from those consultations have been forwarded to the appropriate deans. That means Dr. Eidelman, Dean Eidelman in medicine, and Helen Perot, and myself for education. I'd say 90 to 95% clear on where we need to go with those recommendations. They're being a response to the recommended drafts is being prepared, responses are being prepared, and once we have just a little bit more information, largely one of the most important points of information that we still want to have is, in as much as possible, again, and I hedge these things knowing that things are, that you never know what's going to happen. In as much as possible, there's support from the James Administration Building in renovating the spaces that that the library separates from to be more conducive to general student study spaces. So we hope that we can get that commitment as solidly as we possibly can before these recommendations are finalized. And they will be made available. There are obviously significant changes for the people involved in those libraries. And we know from the changes that we've done in management and in geography that these changes are very difficult for the individuals involved. And also for the people who get new people in their neighborhoods. It's always nice to have a new person in the class. So I hope that everybody will welcome our colleagues who will be just sitting in different spaces, but who are our colleagues and have been all along. I was asked to talk a little bit. This is totally changing subjects. I was asked to talk a little bit about Snoheda and the consultation that we had on space. Some of you were involved in that, and I can tell you, and I've said this before, and I'll probably say it at every Dean's Corner, certainly any time I can get up in the front of the room for anyone to listen to me, and across every dinner table I can possibly find, that it's absolutely clear that we have to reimagine our libraries and how libraries are physically managed here at this university, how we handle collections, how we handle student space, and it does involve major building transformations. It simply will have to. Whether that happens on my watch or the next dean's watch, I don't know. I would rather it happened on my watch. But it has to happen, and it should have happened 10 years ago, and it didn't. And we're now in more of a mess than we were before, but so is almost every other research library that I know of that hasn't had a major building project in the past 10 to 15 years. And we've had small ones, small in great, to all extents and purposes, with music and with law, but those are drops in those libraries. Fill very specialized needs, and we really need to figure out what we're doing with our tremendously important collection and the transformation of our spaces to be to have the most utility for study space in for 21st century pedagogy. So we the little workshop that we had with Snoheda, the people who came are right now the hottest library architects on the block. Snoheda has done what are considered the couple of model libraries that everybody's oohing and aahing over in North America. They also were the architects for the renovation or the building, the new building, the library at Alexandria. They're also the architects for the transformation of Times Square. So they're an architectural firm that's used to dealing with libraries, the very, very cutting-edge libraries. We paid almost nothing for them to come here because that particular process and program was for really the something called the Principals International Advisory Board, an advisory board of very high-level alums that are totally the principal's advisors, exclusively hers, and they wanted to hear more about libraries and McGill and where we thought our libraries were and how we could compare the McGill libraries now and what they might be contrasted to in terms of very, very advanced state-of-the-art librarianship. So that essentially is where it is. It's not our product, it's the principal's product. And that's just what it is. So, and it basically, it cost us a tiny bit more than the cost of getting them here, which was very good. A reminder, I've been asked to just remind people that the Dean's Corner PowerPoint presentations will be available on the U Drive and always can be viewed anytime. And as soon as this meeting is over, we'll make sure that you know where you can get the whole streamed presentation, the entire presentation when it's ready. So I'll take questions anybody has before we finish up, before we go to Isabel's, or I'll also take questions at the end. Maybe I'll do that. Why don't you go through, and any questions that we have at the end for anything, then we'll take them all together, because there's more information, a little bit more information coming out on lots of things They'll come in these presentations, and then you can ask all your questions at once. So, thank you. Whoops. Okay, you can take it from there.
Good afternoon, everybody. So, as Connie mentioned earlier...
Whoops. Yeah.
So as Colleen mentioned to you earlier, 26 of our staff colleagues elected to retire in the month of August. So for people like numbers, here's the breakdown per unit for a total of 26. And I've added name of some of our colleagues who wanted to share the good news with the rest of the unit. So congratulations to all of you. And best wishes on this new adventure that you will soon embark. We will also say goodbye to Lisa Kett, the e-resources coordinator, part of the collection services, who will be retiring in just a few months on August 31st. More farewell. Soon, Catherine will leave her friends from education to go on her maternity leave. Again, good luck, Catherine. I don't know if you're here or from afar. She is, okay. All excused. And also Vinci from McDonald campus, let us know a few weeks ago that she would move to Toronto, where she will start a new adventure. So, congratulations, you'll be missed. With farewells comes welcome. We will be welcoming Tara back in just a few weeks. She'll be joining her friends in Schulich after her mat leave. Marika joined us almost a month ago from her mat leave also, so welcome back, Marika. And Sarah Severson, that maybe some of you have met during the job talk for the digitization and preservation position, will be joining us on July 2nd. Sarah will bring more expertise to the digitization group and definitely will be a key asset in this revisioning of the library and document delivery that Colleen was mentioning about. On the recruitment side, at the end of the month of June, June 20th and June 21st, we will be tackling the Senior Director of Digital Initiative position. We have three candidates lined up, so the interviews will be held on June 20th in the afternoon, the morning of June 21st, and the afternoon of June 21st. So be on the lookout for more information about the job talks. Some of our colleagues were, I'm sure, very pleased to receive last week this wonderful news from the Provo office announcing that they had obtained tenure. So congratulations to you, Jill, Amber, and Macy. I don't know if you're in the room, but congratulations. More on the congratulations side, Jill Barouf received the 2013 Emerging Leader Award from the CHLA Association. Congratulations, Jill. Francisco Oliva from the Dean's Office graduated from the LDP, the Leadership Development Program, developed by McGill. And we have Andrew Senior. I don't know if Andrew is with us. Who just received his MLIS just a few weeks ago, and also Jillian Tum, who finally got this her PhD just last week. So congratulations to all of you. That's it for the HR updates. So I guess we'll keep the question for the end and move to facilities update. Colleen, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Don't forget the mic.
Good. Well, good afternoon, all. I'll be updating you on the facilities news. Some you've heard before. I'll just repeat again the progress we're making with a number of our facilities projects. First of all, you've probably noticed that the Redpath Terrace is just about ready to begin. You can see the workmen preparing the trees and getting the area ready. The timeline for this project, the construction will physically start on Monday, this coming Monday, but the door has been shut to Redpath. So the McLennan doors are now the only entrance into the library. The three doors that are affected, we've talked about it before, but I'll repeat it again. The entranceway into Redpath Hall along the terrace, the entranceway that allows a lot of our LTS people enter via the doorway between Redpath Hall and Redpath Library will be closed, and the McLennan the Redpath entrance will be closed. Signage is trickling in, and you will see it all up and running in various stages starting today. The heavy drilling, we've been reassured, will stop by 10 a.m. So for those of you that are early birds, just be prepared for noise, especially at the demolition stage. Before 10 a.m. And the fire exit plan, I was at the, Francisco and Bruna and I were at the project launch with all of the contractors, everyone involved, and the fire safety man was there, and he has reassured us that he will have the fire exit plan in writing that we'll distribute to all staff in the complex by June 11th. Meanwhile, all fire exits are as you know them. It's just that the Redpath doorway is shut. Okay. So the main floor is remaining open. The street level is closed. And you've seen that the CyberTech is in darkness. So the food court, CyberTech, copy center, washrooms, access to the tunnel, that floor is closed. And that's to allow the workmen and contractors to get the job done faster. Now, students with disabilities, anyone with accessibility issues, will be able to gain access to the library when it is open. They simply have to register with the Office for Students with Disabilities. The contact information is here, and all of our HUSL staff will have this at the service counter. They simply register. Their card will, they will be given Linnell card access to the service point and a key to the elevator. So they will be able to get in, but they must register with OSD. So those are for our students and faculty who are unable to enter via the McLennan entrance. Students, anyone that a non-McGill user will be able to enter during service hours through the service point. They're not open the same hours that the library is open, so they will simply need to call security, and security will come and escort them in through the service point. Hopefully this isn't hopefully the numbers won't be huge, but security has reassured us that they will handle this, and we'll work through it with them. The Redpath Terrace, part of the project, requires some asbestos abatement. I wanted to let you know that the asbestos that's being removed is the area over the Redpath entrance and the area around the staircase that's being removed. So this is all being handled through the contractors and authorized asbestos removal people following CSST standards. So it will be safe and secure. It will be wrapped, sealed, and they'll follow all the same procedures that they must. And it's just that area around the Redpath entrance. Just to remind you how gorgeous it's going to be, when it's done. And having been at the launch, it should be done by November. But, you know, expect the end of the year. And it will be lovely with seating and so on. And we're working with the planning office for the terrace to be non-smoking with designated smoking sections. So we'll be working through the policy group and the planning office on that. Now, the other project that's underway throughout the McLennan Redpath, this is the busy building, that's for sure, is a lighting upgrade. And this is being funded through Hydro-Québec and the McGill Utilities and Energy Office. They're going to be upgrading the lighting to a more efficient lighting model. It's for those of you that know lights, moving from T12 to T8, which is much more energy efficient. And they're throughout the building, we'll be putting motion sensors in so that if no one is in the space, the lights are off. When someone walks into the space, the lights go on. This is very common in Europe and more in public buildings in North America. So it's to reduce energy consumption and to dramatically reduce costs over time. This project has started, and it will run through to the end of April. The contractors, the lighting people, will be in here between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. What they're doing is they're replacing those light fixtures, and they're adding motion sensors. The main corridors throughout the stacks will be continually lit. So if you walk onto the sixth floor of McLennan, all the corridors will be brightly lit. If you decide to go into a stack to retrieve a book, as you move into the stack, the sensor detects you and the light goes on and it stays on for 30 minutes. So, same with staff areas. There will be sensors in the staff areas. However, you will have light switches too if you want to turn lights on and off. That's still available to you. So the work has started. They've been down in the basement of McLennan. They're now on the sixth floor. If you would like a demonstration, Francisco Oliva will... you can contact him. You can go up. I'm not quite sure which section the demo is in, but
the northeast section of the building, there's going to be a planning there.
Yes.
But I can show
explain
a little bit of the technology and show the
great. So a demo can be done by Francisco and a tour of the area. Don't hesitate to contact him. Great. Just briefly, we're progressing with further refurbishments that have been funded by the students. The Arts Undergraduate Society funded the additional seating, 37 seats in the former reference area, and the reference collection has been streamlined and moved to the other side of the floor. That's underway, and we've finished the installation of 32 extra seats in the CyberTech. Another project that's being funded through the SSMU Library Improvement Fund is an additional 58 electrified tables with seating for the main floor of McLennan. That will be a summer project. You'll see that unfolding. And finally, the green wall is in place. This was completely funded from a donation from the Class Action Group, Class Action 2013, the graduating class. It's an irrigated system, and it's currently installed on the bridge between McLennan and Redpath. We'll see if that position works well for the plants. So that is now in place, and we thank the Class Action Group for that donation. I can take questions on refurbishments or construction if you have them, or we can, if you might think of them. Yes, Susan.
There's been some slight communication glitch because I was just being railed against
by someone who's a shelver who tells me those lights only stay on for 10 minutes.
Oh, that's probably true because
they were testing.
Yeah, it was a simple test. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. No, it's 30 minutes. The lighting contractor was finding the right spot for the sensor, and they will stay on for 30 minutes when they're installed throughout. Yes?
Will there be advanced warning when workers will come and turn off the lights?
Yes. Yeah, the question was, will there be advance warning for staff when they come into the floor or the unit? Yes, you'll be contacted through the project manager. And they will cover the desk with, it's a very quick fix. Literally, they take the old ballast out and put the new one in, and it takes about 10 minutes per light. But you will know. Thank you for that. Okay. I think it's Louis.
Shouldn't be too long. In order to comply with our, with the McGill Library e-resources, right there. There you go. All right. So we have to make some kind of modification. As of July 1st, this is within the teaching hospital of the McGill, we'll have making the changes, the switch, like all the McGill authorized users, McGill students, faculty, staff, and resident students, will still continue to have access as it is right now, as it was until now. And non-McGill, true McGill authorized users will no longer have access to the quantity of e-resources that we have, meaning that they will solely have access to limited resources that will be available within each of the teaching hospitals that they will have signed agreements with. And I want to tell you that this has nothing to do with the cuts that we have right now, the massive library and McGill cuts. This is something that was planned many years ago. We've been working on that for quite a few years now. And last year, we came up with July 1st of this year to do this thing here. There will be a massive communication plan as of tomorrow sent to all McGill community and all the teaching hospitals also as well. We'll have a big FAQ list about all the questions and answers about what this, what if that, if this, everything. So what's going to happen July 1st, gradually access to many of our resources will be pulled out. And that's it. That's all I have. So, questions at the end of it right now? Any questions? Yes?
Is our reporter still authenticated?
All the ones who have credentials, that's all I can say, will have access. Oh. I'm sure it all.
Actually, I did have a doctor from one of the hospitals, I don't remember his name, called me up the other day asking me for a password. And he said he was an authorized McGill user and that he had a regular McGill email address, which is that count? Is somebody tells you they have a McGill email address.
Many we call clinicians or doctors who are in those hospitals who are not aware they have dual McGill joint. I call it joint appointment. Thank you. Then they have that. It's the reason they do not aware of that they already have that. So there are all the instructions in the FAQ list, how to go, where to go, to turn it on, to activate their account.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I ended up referring him to ICS at the same time. Yeah. Can I give you a password?
No. We're not. No. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to introduce Chris and tell you why he's doing this. So, Chris, there are a number of things that we have been acquiring in Osler that are very special. And it's sort of why a lot of us are librarians, because this is some of the most fun part of what we do. And we thought that it would be very good for us to share with you some of these materials and some of the ceremonies, a little bit about the ceremonies that we've had around them. And it's also really important to point out that I think exclusively all of these materials were funded through philanthropy. So none of the money that could have, the money that went to these would not have gone to anything else. And it's really important at this day and age to explain that. So,
thank you. Good afternoon. It's good to see everyone. Let's see if I can do this. Is that sufficient? Thank you, Dale. There we go. So I'm here to share with you a couple of recent acquisitions, but perhaps equally importantly, to put a seed in your minds, especially those of you who are liaison librarians or branch heads. But I'll leave that point to the end. The first thing I wanted to share with you is this beautiful 1759 anatomical atlas published in Paris entitled The Exposition Anatomique de la Structure du Corps Humain en 20 planches imprimées avec les couleurs naturelles by Jacques Gauthier et Dagoté. This is from 1759. It is a life-size atlas. You'll get a sense of the scope of the book, but it's about this big, and if you take two of the plates together, you have a full body, okay? Come and see this sometime. I'd be delighted to show you. I'll give you a sense of another one. This is an extremely rare atlas, in part because doctors for lectures or in dissecting room would disbound this book, put them together, and then use it as a guide for teaching or for the dissecting. So there are only 18 known copies in the world. We're the only one who has one in Canada, and the other ones are in elite institutions like Harvard or Yale or the Bibliothèque Interuniversitaire or Bibliothèque Nationale de France. So we're the only people in Canada who have it. It puts us in this category where we want to be in this level. Now, what makes this an interesting book is the fact that it's the color is done mechanically. Now, traditionally, coloring would be done by hand. But in this case, there are four primary color plates that are put one on top of the other and colors mixed in order to give it this color. The results are really stunning. This slide does not give you the vibrancy of the color of it. Also, Dagoté, of which we have other examples of his work, has an almost surrealistic approach to it. And as you can see up in the upper left corner, there's a heart there as well. And he has these very interesting, almost like Salvador Dali-esque, anatomical illustrations, which are really cool, and be interested in showing them to you. So an acquisition like this is important not only for the history of medicine, but also for people who do the history of printing or art historians in particular. Now, as Colleen mentioned, this is not something that we can afford to buy, and things like this are often not things we can afford to buy. So we had to have a special fundraising to raise the money for this. And it was just over $100,000 Canadian. This never comes on the market. So when an opportunity for this came up to acquire it, it was a wonderful addition to our collection of, and I won't be modest, we have a fantastic world-class collection of anatomical atlases. And when things like this come up, you A, have to move quickly, and B, have to really do a whip around to get a lot of funds. And you can see some of the donors in there. That's the Chancellor on the left. And that's Rolando Del Maestro, Dr. Del Maestro on the right, who's chair of the Standing Committee of the Board of Curators. And we spearheaded an effort to raise the money to acquire this book. And we did it in the name of the principal, in her honor. You can see her there, second from left. So we were able to raise the money so that we could acquire it for the library on her behalf in recognition of her 10.5 years here. And we had a ceremony at the Ulster on the 30th. And it was a very moving ceremony, I think it's fair to say. She was incredibly touched by this gesture. She spoke of how meaningful libraries were to her in her career, and how having something, a record, a tangible record, in our collection was something that she found very important and very moving. The second recent acquisition was thanks to the Friends of the Library. And the Friends of the Library is a support group, and they had raised some money and were looking for a project. And this is another item that came up on the market. This is a photographic album in the early years of photographic reproduction. So it's the Iconographie Photographique de la Salpêtrière. And this is a very, very important work, in particular in the history of psychiatry, because it was based on the work of Dr. Martin Charcot, this great 19th century physician, who was codifying and normalizing hysteria as an illness. And part of his technique was to use photography, then in its infancy, and he took a number of photographs of the stages of hysteria in order to document them and then share them with people. This work is an important work, not only in the history of medicine, but in the history of photography as well. This is a great addition to our collection because we've had the Nouvelle Iconographie, which is a 28-volume successor. We never had the original, and it drove me crazy. So I've been looking for this for years. It came on the market in Amsterdam, and I was able to get in touch with the vendor and say, hold this for us, I'll see what I can do. But thankfully, the friends of the library stepped in at that point and said, this is important. No one else in Canada has this, so we're really pleased to have it. I'll show you another image from the same book, it's three volumes, this one. And I wanted to use this as the icon for my fundraising activities. Please give me money. Please. All he needs is $100,000. Please. So I got that. And okay, so here is my plea to you. We have terrific special collections here. We have terrific rare material. People love using it. It's part of the raw material of research on the one hand. There's also a visceral thrill to show this to people. So not only yourselves, but in the students you work with, in the researchers you have, or in the guests you bring to the library. If you ever can see an opportunity or want to explore opportunities for collaborations with the Osler Library, please feel free to contact me. Or if you ever just want to see this material yourself, because how many of you have held a medieval manuscript in your hands? If you ever want to just come up to say, I held a medieval manuscript in my hands, come and do that. It's one of the great joys of being here, and I look for any and all opportunities for collaboration, sharing, or just plain having a good time. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Chris. That was really fun. A lot of you out there are great teachers, and we just saw a great example of that. Chris and Stephen have worked enormous numbers of hours, countless hours in raising money for these acquisitions. They are not easily gotten. And there's a phenomenal amount of stewardship that goes into these acquisitions. I just have to say that I'm very grateful and I'm very supportive of these types of activities. Because in my worldview, my Weltanschauung, materials like this truly do belong in the kind of libraries, the research libraries that we have at McGill. I think these things belong to all of humankind, and when we have them in places like this, then they truly find the homes where they need to be. So I just want to say thank you, and truly it is really a thrill when you touch these things and hold them. And I'm not so sure about putting that on your business card with a... But it's just a spectacular acquisition. They were absolutely spectacular acquisitions. We'll also have Voltaire coming on, too, which is pretty cool for McGill. And also totally fundraised by many, many, many people who have given us money for that. So in terms of another celebration, you know that we normally recognize our staff and librarian award winners now at the staff barbecue, but we aren't having one, and it's probably this year because of tightening our belts, but it's probably just as good, too, because it probably would have rained on us or been awfully cold. So instead, we're doing it here. And I would like to first announce, I'll do a little reading here, so I apologize. That Lucy Frenette, administrative coordinator for McDonald Campus Library, who has served the library for 30 years, is the winner of the staff award for this year. And I'd like to recognize. And Maya can tell you what it's like to be stared at while people talk about you. So we're gonna do a little bit of this. She's had practice. She gets to do it again in a minute. Lucy Frenette, as I said, has served the University Library for over 30 years. As administrator coordinator at McDonald, Lucy's proactive, diligent approach to addressing the library's needs, both internally with staff and externally with users, inspires great confidence and trust. In 2011-2012, Lucy was tasked with being the McDonald Campus Library liaison with ICS, Ancillary Services, and Xerox around the UPrint initiative. Drawing on her attention to detail and reliability, Lucy spent countless hours communicating with all parties involved in order to keep updated on new developments and directives. She produced new library protocols, found solutions to technical problems, all while steadily assisting students, faculty, and her colleagues with the transition. She also organized work and equipment space configuration for maximum efficiency. She holds a high regard for the work environment, safety, and sustainability. Constant improvements are paramount, and she handles all space-related projects with rigor from beginning to end. Over her years at McGill, Lucy has also served as the in-house expert, the person staff and faculty members turn to for advice in a multitude of areas. She is gifted at identifying the most relevant information and communicating it concisely to her colleagues. In addition, Lucy's breadth of experience in logistics and event planning has ensured the smooth functioning of everyday activities alongside special events and meetings. Thank you so much for your service for so much, so many years. And yes, Maya, you have to get up and stand up here once more. Maya didn't get her certificate on stage.
The tube was empty.
Yes, nothing worse than getting an empty tube. So this is the real thing. Congratulations, Maya. Since joining the library in 2008, Maya has made a significant impact both as a liaison librarian and as the interim head of the education library. As interim head, she led a team of librarians and staff through numerous projects, including the establishment of a single service point, the relocation of materials onto compact shelving, and the collaborative reimagining and reintegration of the library's curriculum resource and children's young adult literature collections. She has been instrumental in improving the collection, aligning the resources with curriculum and research priorities, as well as publicizing and creating aids for acquisition to maximize their use. Maya is also deeply integrated in the Faculty of Education. She is an inspiring instructor, and her expertise in children's literature has led her to the classroom with an invitation from the Department of Integrated Studies and Education to be co-instructor for children's literature, a three-credit course required by the Bachelor's of Education program. Congratulations. So this is why we're having punch and cookies, by the way. We don't always have it for this. We thought that we'd have a little celebration. So, I know that I said that I would save questions to last. I don't know if anyone else waits with bated breath to see what the martlet's going to do, but I always like to see what the martlet's going to do. Oh, rats, okay. Get back to it anyway. I thought it might move. It doesn't. Okay. Now Marika's going to freak out that it's not moving, and
no, it's not supposed to move.
And everything will have to move.
The graduate is standing still for us.
Okay, the graduate's standing still for us. Okay, well, I will be, again, congratulations to Lucy and to Maya for work, for the very best in librarianship and library work. Thank you, indeed, on behalf of all of us. Okay, does anyone, we've had a lot of information coming out today, and we have a full room, and we have a number of people off-site, too. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to take them. One thing that I noted in Diane's remarks is that she didn't make it clear that the closure of the Red Path library door is a permanent thing, as far as we know right now. One of the things we, in terms of budget cuts, we are also experiencing, we're also being affected by budget cuts from other places on campus. Security is down by half to two-thirds. And so whereas we did have three security officers in this library complex who were not on our payroll, but Central University's payroll, we will now have one. And so we will not be able to monitor two entrances and exits. We will only be able to take care of one. So that's actually how most libraries are built now, anyway. You only have one entrance and exit for security purposes, anyway. It will remain a fire exit, so safety issues are not a problem. Okay, does anybody have any questions about anything? You don't have to have questions, but if you do, yes. Yes.
I first thought that maybe you would be bombing McLennan and then starting new, but with all the renovations, I guess that's not going to happen.
But the comment was, wouldn't it be nice to bomb the library here and start anew? And that's we don't know what's going to happen. That in the best of all possible worlds, yeah, we would probably start over from scratch. But we do have a number of heritage site issues, and we will have to do whatever we can do with the money at our disposal, whatever that is. So I'm hedging like crazy. I don't know. It would be. But we're this close to not having a choice and just having to do something. I mean, we're just past the point of needing to really, really look at our buildings and see what we need to do.
So that's a yes.
I have no idea and hope for the best. I'm an optimistic and an optimist in these things. I mean, I think something will happen sometime. Sooner rather than later. And the good thing about McGill and Quebec and this city is that how it's happened is that we will not, this library will not have gone through several very expensive interim stages that others have. We'll go from here to here instead of from here to here, here to here, here to here. And saves a lot of money, but it's going to be pretty dramatic when we finally do make a change, I think. Other questions? Yes.
I just want to say I have 2 points, and I was just getting back to the closure of life sciences, library, and education. I sat in on a couple of consultations in the town hall, and the people in that room were made up of faculty and staff and students, and they weren't so quiet as this room when it came to talk about these. Their precious library, their spaces of teaching and learning closing. They weren't so quiet as this room is, and I'm saddened by that. It is a great loss, and the people that use those two libraries know it, and they're not so quiet. And this room is dead quiet, and there's that. I find that very sad. I'll just add another point. You mentioned that 26 administrative staff and support staff have except if the packages. And I just want people to know that there's only 92 support staff workers in the whole library system, 92. And now we've lost 24 of them. So we've got 68 people to do the work that was, you know, done by 92. And then you tell us you're going to move us around. And I just hope, like, I would just get a commitment from you, like, publicly said, heard, that you will sit down with us and allow us some input. Some people are going to want to move together and not be split up. They're a unit. They want to move with that precious collection you talk about. Not just the valuable collection that exists in Osler, but there are collections that are used, too. They're of worth. And people want to move with the librarians, and they want to move together. And I would like you to consider that, and not to split groups up, and to plug up the holes that you've created. That's it.
As I said, there are lots and lots and lots of strong feelings. I mean, none of what we're doing right now is easy. I know that in terms of just to make sure that we're talking apples and oranges, I think our support staff is, and EMS is 120.
Yeah, altogether.
Altogether it's 120. Just so that, and that's the number we've been using all along, because that was the number that was eligible, because it was those groups who were eligible for this retirement incentive program. So it's not quite as dramatic as you're suggesting.
92 minus 24.
No, it's 120
LA
minus 26.
LAs and Ts and Cs.
And we're talking about... Yes, we've got people in archives, and we've got, so anyway, I just want to correct that because we've got the numbers. So, yes, it is going to be different. And, yes, we will be doing things differently. And, yes, we will be doing, there will be things that we won't be doing at all. One example of that is the kind of security that we're doing, that we had. We were keeping the buildings open 24/5 by virtue of security personnel, and we're no longer paying them, and we're no longer keeping the buildings open. So we will not, you know, I've said all along, and we will do this because it's not only the legal thing, it's the right thing to do. We will not ask people to work beyond the collective bargaining agreement, and we will not ask people to work out of their classification. We will do what is possible. We will not ask people to do things that are impossible. And as I said twice, and I will say for the third time, I really understand that people, that insofar as we can possibly manage, we honor people's wishes for where they work and the type of work that they're doing and the spaces in which they work and with whom they work. We will honor that as best we can. But in the end, it's my job and it's my responsibility to make sure that with the resources we have at our disposal, that we provide the best library services that we can to the most number of people. And so that is what we will do with less money and a different kind of constellation of staff than we had before. There, as I said, really is important to understand that these changes, I mean, well before I got here, for the past two directors, there have been significant changes that have been going on in the library. Actually, since Bruna started to work, we can probably blame it all on her. I think there were 35 or 36 libraries when she started to work, and there are a lot fewer now. Who else's fault could it possibly be?
There were actually 60 libraries in 1968.
Okay. We just don't need. I mean, when I worked at my first job was a student worker at the physics, math, astronomy library at the University of Texas at Austin. And I shelved, because I kind of like this, and that's what student workers did. I shelved Scientific American and Science News and Nature and Physics Letters and Physics Review and Mathematical Reviews. And two blocks down, a block and a half down, a library that my son worked in as a student at the University of Texas at Austin, the engineering library. At the time that I was doing it, we were shelving the same things there. You would look at the periodical list and there would be 20 copies of these things all over campus. That's not how we run libraries anymore. And that engineering library that my son was working in and he just graduated a year and a half ago is gone now. It's gone because everything is just, they're all merging. The Scripps Library, the great Oceanographic Institute in San Diego, the Scripps Library closed. My colleague at the University of San Diego had to stand up and tell a distinguished colleague who was 94 years old that his library was closing. So these aren't we do live in times that are fundamentally changing. It's not only libraries and technology, it's the total communities of academe, and how we're doing things is tremendously different. Okay, other questions? Yes?
You mentioned a phase two that wasn't going to affect us so much. What is phase two?
Phase two is layoffs. Phase one was volunteer retirement. The university has a target of 340-ish. It has a dollar amount as a target, represented by what they think is probably about 340 headcount. And we have to have that many fewer people. And the first attempt, the first way, phase one, to reduce that number on the payroll was through a voluntary incentive voluntary retirement program. Phase two will be layoffs to come up with that number. There's no way 26 people are going to be laid off from the library. There are not 26 people whom we could lay off in the library.
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
Okay, obviously we will not be as affected by that because we are demographic. We have a lot of people who could retire, and we don't have very many people who are not job secured in the library. So we will not be as affected in terms of numbers. I can't comment on that one way or another because it's a university-wide thing, and I'm not sure that they know, they meaning big HR, knows yet exactly how many people took the volunteer retirement program and how much money it was, and therefore how many people might have to be laid off. We just don't know yet. And I know it's not a pleasant position for any of us to live through this time of not knowing. It's uncomfortable at best. Horrible, probably, at more aptly said.
Maybe you've done your part, in terms of your 1.8. Maybe you've done enough, and maybe you can say that's enough. I want to save my two people.
I would, I can guarantee you that I will try my best.
Okay.
That's all I can say. You know, that's all I can say. Believe me, if you sit in the, any person who sits in the dean's office, as I've tried to make clear, you know, I have a lot of responsibility and I have a lot of authority and I can do what I can do and then I can't do. And one thing I will always, always, always try to make clear are those things that I can control and I can do something about, and those things I can't control and those things I can't do anything about. At some point with this program, I will not be in control. I don't want you to think that I am. I will have powers of persuasion, but that's what I'll have. And those I will use as much as I possibly can. That's the reality of it. Any other thoughts, questions? We will keep you informed. All along, as soon as I find out things, I will let you know as soon as I find, as soon as I can be pretty guaranteed that what I give you is accurate, I will let you know. We will continue to do this. Yes?
Would it be possible to have something like a weekly update about the changes, staffing changes, current moving, stuff like this, that we can expect regularly to come out in writing?
Marika, do you want to talk about your plans for...
Yes.
Why don't you come up in here, because you get the microphone. We knew that this was going to be an issue.
Very loud.
No, you have to.
All right, Stuart. All right.
Hi. So as you know, hi everyone. I just got back a month ago, so. Come and talk to me and come and see me. I'm Marika. I'm the communications officer at the library. And what we're starting to work on right now, as you know, you receive a weekly update usually on Fridays. We'd like to kind of reformat it, rejig it a bit to include items that Rebecca mentioned and to have it look somewhat like the What's New at McGill, so that it's not as heavy as it is when you receive it, and that it's really succinct and will be linked to longer pieces if you're interested in reading them. So we are working on it right now. In terms of timeline, I'm hoping soon, but I just got back, so I'm going to try and figure out my workflow, but it's on the top of our priority list. So I hope that that's okay in terms of an answer. Yes?
I meant more like, I'm just wondering when we're going to start hearing specific about stuff. Like, who's planning specific things, or like when things are starting and expecting to finish?
We will do that as soon as those decisions have been made, and I can absolutely guarantee you that none of those decisions have been made yet. We're just beginning to work on this. Just beginning. The first thing that had to, there were two crucial events this week. One was the deadline for the volunteer retirement program, and the other was the handing in the sets of recommendations for education and for life sciences. With those two things together, we can start to make more concrete plans, and as soon as those plans come more into focus, we will let you know. Lori can tell you, Lori didn't get her chance to talk to you very much today or at all today about LiveQual and about ClimateQual because there was just too much going on. But I can tell you that one of the main themes, if not the main theme, that came out of ClimateQual was communication, and more communication. There is no way that you can over-communicate in an organization this size, as disparate as it is, with the hours that people work. And that's why, from the very beginning, we've tried very hard to communicate in different ways. But it is something very much on our minds. And if they're, you know, help us with ideas, I appreciate your bringing it up, because it is something that we've talked about already, knowing that we were going to have to do something at least as effective as we did, as we were doing during the strike, because people simply have to know what's going on. And it's a lot better that you hear from us the real stuff rather than make it up in the halls and then pass it around. And then we have to undo that bad information before you start to believe the real stuff. Okay? Okay, well, I want to make sure that everybody point people to the cookies and grapes. And thank you all very much. And be sure and congratulate our award winners. Thank you.